This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. Provocative is a word often linked with the name Camille Paglia, an academic turned cultural critic. She has never shied away from controversy, starting with her now famous book, Sexual Personae. The humanities professor at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia has continually dispensed passionate views on everything from feminism to the role of religion in American politics. Now she turns her intellectual powers on the pleasures of poetry. In her new book, Break, Blow, Burn, she argues that the way poetry is taught today often strips the art form of its power and context. Having grown up with a reverence for poetry, she laments a world that says poetic language no longer speaks to it. Her book is an effort to teach readers how to reconnect with the power and pleasures of poetry. Does poetry speak to you? And if so, how? Whose poetry holds the most power for you and why? Join our conversation. The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later on, we'll hear more about the newly announced Pulitzer Prize winners, and we'll read from your letters. But first, in honor of National Poetry Month, Camille Paglia joins us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you so much. It's great being here.
Tell us, why poetry? Why are you writing about poetry, and why now?
Well, people may not realize that 13 chapters of the 20-odd in Sexual Personae were about poetry. I feel that poetry and art are, visual arts, are very interrelated, and that the general public these days is becoming swamped in mass media and losing contact with the spiritual dimension of the fine arts, as well as the tremendous quality and staying power of some of these canonical works that I've put in Break, Blow, Burn.
Before we talk about your frustrations with modern poetry, some modern poetry, what is it about poetry that you love, that has been an enduring love for you through your life?
Poetry in general?
Yes.
Well, for me, it's almost a holy writ. It's like it is a kind of magic. Poetry, to me, is close to incantation. And I think that the way literature has been taught in this era of post-structuralism and postmodernism is exactly the opposite of that. There's a kind of mechanized cynicism stripping away everything which is most lovely and suggestive about the fine arts. I'm trying to restore the pleasure principle to our engagement with art, and also trying to show how uncanny it is that no matter how many times you do study a great work of art, a great poem, a great painting, there's still something that remains elusive.
Now, one of the poets included in your book, not surprisingly, I would say, is Emily Dickinson, and I know that's she is one of your favorite poets as well. We have a reading of one of her poems, one of the poems that is included in the book. Wanted to listen to that and then talk a little bit about this poem in particular. It is Because I Could Not Stop for Death, and this will be read by the actress Julie Harris. Let's hear that now.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility. We passed the school where children played at wrestling in a ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity.
That was the actress Julie Harris reading Because I Could Not Stop for Death by Emily Dickinson. That's one of the poems that's included in Camille Paglia's new book, Break, Blow, and Burn. Ms. Paglia, why is this one of the poems, and why is Emily Dickinson, one of the poets, included in your book?
Well, I've been obsessed with Emily Dickinson since college. In the 1960s, we probably were definitely were the first generation to have the benefit of the great Harvard editions of Dickinson's work that were published in the 1950s. For the first time, thanks to the scholar Thomas H. Johnson, we were able to see the poems exactly as Dickinson had left them, with her odd dashes and her capitalizations, with her dissonant off rhymes and all her anticipations of jazz rhythms. The great Emily Dickinson boom following her death in the 1890s was based on doctored poetry, a lot of namby-pamby stuff that her family put out. Her poems were forced to conventionally rhyme and so on. So all of the incongruities and the disturbances, the eerie disturbances in Dickinson had been purged out of her. I did my senior thesis on her in college, and there's a whole chapter about her in my book, Sexual Persone, where I call her Amherst Madame de Sade. I think that people sentimentalize her. She wasn't just this like poor dear wren of a creature who was pining for some man who abandoned her. I mean, this was a formidable mind, a kind of scientific mind. So the poems I chose are not favorites of mine, but they work very well in the classroom. They've been tested through many years of classroom teaching. But beyond that, because I Could Not Stop for Death is an amazing creation, there's this chatty, conventional woman, an adult woman, who's suddenly caught unaware by death, who comes to her door. She mistakes him for a gentleman caller. And so she goes gladly with him into a carriage, and instead of having just a nice little roundabout around the town plaza, they're heading for the countryside. Now, right there, there's a problem. Okay? She's being kidnapped. And she has to sort of say farewell to everything that she recognizes, all the known world, until she suddenly realizes, all right, that she is in the throes of death, and that he is a murderer. He is a rapist. She will be seduced and abandoned, just dropped with a thump into the grave at the end of this a poem. So at the very end, we have this sense of terror as she and we face the fact of this, of immortality, of eternity, and of the extinction of consciousness.
You know, as I was listening to that, I couldn't help but thinking, I hear that, and I can hear how amazing it is and how wonderful it is. And yet, like so many people, I think I appreciate poetry sort of in theory almost, but it's not, I don't often pick up a book of poetry and begin to read poems. And I think that's something you're also trying to address with this
exactly.
book.
Exactly, because poetry used to be part of American culture very deeply throughout the 19th century, well into the 20th century. Just ordinary people, not just educated people, thought of poetry as expressing the American spirit. And I can remember still the 1950s, you'd see poems in the daily newspaper or in women's magazines. And that for some reason, that's gone. Even though the 1960s, when I was in college, was such a boom era for poetry, when poetry became a performance art. The readings at my college at SUNY Binghamton in upstate New York were just overflowing with kids. We were rapt, as if the poets were bards, coming to us and telling us about the cosmos and about the world of politics and everything else. Now, what happened? What happened? Well, part of it is the dominance of mass media that has pushed the fine arts out. The fine arts have a great difficulty taking root in the U.S. We are a practical country. We've been that, very business-oriented, since the Puritan era. Therefore, we must make, educators must be evangelists, okay, for art, to help to keep the fine arts in the public eye. But instead, our universities, from the 70s on, became citadels of deconstruction, as if to say that the very works that had been put in their custodianship, okay, in trust to them, were to be vandalized. So we have a nation of vandals in the humanities departments, and not only that, but our NEA, okay, for many years became a kind of a victim of unfortunate political quarrels. It's now stabilized, but nevertheless, a great damage has been done, I think, to the image of the arts. I'm trying to address in my in my book, both ends of the political spectrum. I have Break, Blow, Burn contains religious poems as well as poems of radical social protest, like that of William Blake. And I'm trying to make both sides see the limitations in the positions, now ritual positions, they've taken in the culture wars. I'm afraid that conservatives tend to feel that art is a scam, that the artist is a con artist, because of those controversies of the late 80s and early 90s over, and late 90s too, over sacrilegious art of a tenth rate nature, in my view, right? And then on the side of the art world, I have to say that I feel that there is too much snobbery, too much sanctimony, a kind of thing like, well, we have somehow the key, the code to the avant-garde, and everyone else are the great unwashed. Well, that we've got to get over that. Our artists should be addressing the people as a whole. Their mission is to take in the whole of America. They must start addressing those with whom they do not agree, not just the preacher of the choir.
All right, Camille Paglia, with the caveat that we have probably about a minute and a half before we have to take a break. Uh-huh. I just want to ask you, what criteria can you summarize the criteria used for choosing the poems that you included in this book?
The first half of the book are canonical poems from Shakespeare on through the centuries. They're works that were tested in the classroom. The second half are contemporary poems that I went out and tried to find, and the leading poets of our era failed to make the cut for this book. I found almost unknown poems by unknown poets who I felt had these were artifacts that could stand up to the strong poems that precede them.
All right. Well, we are talking with Camille Paglia about her new book on poetry, and we will continue our discussion about that book, Break, Blow, and Burn, and about the art of poetry and its importance in our culture when we continue. If you read poetry, why and who are your favorite poets? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Or send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking with Camille Paglia about her new book, Break, Blow, Burn, an analysis of some of the best Western poems and poets. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to take a call now from Alistair, and he's calling from Oregon. Hi, Alistair.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I was very happy to hear the sentiments so close to mine echoed in the appreciation and focus you gave to Emily Dickinson in your most recent work. I would say her poetry, and especially the Johnson edition, which you gave such high praise to, has been a constant companion to me throughout all of my life and poetic exploration. And I really find many of Dickinson's poems, despite the fact that she was known for being such a great confessionalist, she also exercise such great subtlety and conspicuous attention to form, which is oftentimes lost in many modern practitioners.
And also her attention to the individual word. She was a great student of her dictionary. She plays often with the etymologies, the history of the word. And that's another thing I'm trying to get contemporary writers to get back to focus on style, to focus on the power that one word can have. So Dickinson is reading Dickinson is a great discipline.
And you're so right. No one seems to care about it anymore when it all seems to be about the gut and the spleen seems to be primarily what...
Right. That's so true. I see even novel after novel come out, acclaimed, praised, this and that, and look at it, and it's just the slackness of the prose, and including the degeneration of prose and the major newspapers. There's just very few places you can go these days to appreciate language as style. Right. Poetry allows you to do that.
And I always go back to her masterful words of... tell all the truth, but tell it slant.
Yes.
And circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise.
Yes.
So I've always tried to keep that in mind.
Thanks so much for your call.
Yes, indeed.
Just to get back for a moment, Camille Paglia, to I know that part of what you've said, you want to do is sort of reignite, I think, an interest in poetry. And something that I thought you said that was very interesting in your introduction to the book is that reading poetry or approaching poetry is a little like meditation, the concentration that you need. What do you mean by that? Explain that a little more.
Yes, I think that especially the short lyric poem requires a kind of contemplative style that's almost like approaching a passage of scripture. You look at the poem on the page almost in the same way as you see a painting on the wall surrounded by white. You have to make yourself very calm and still. A great poem speaks to you. And poetry is a function of the spoken voice. Now that's rather radical in certain circles because in post-structuralism, the author is dead, the text barely exists. It's constantly deconstructing itself, and certainly a text has no connection to the spoken voice. But for me, poetry by definition activates subliminally certain rhythms in the body that we actually feel as we even when we read silently, when we're in the face of a poem, I think that we can feel our muscles having slight tremors in the jaw area, the neck, etc. Poetry is a matter of the breath force. Inspiration literally means a breathing into. So, by the way, I just want to say you mentioned you said reignite. I want to reignite an interest in poetry. Exactly right. What I'm trying to counter is the false cool and cynicism of postmodernism and post-structuralism, which has produced a certain snide style of commentary coming out of people in the Ivy League, and there's a way of talking down to everything all the time, okay? And I want to say, I feel, even though I'm an atheist, I feel kin to the evangelist, to the evangelical movement, okay? People who have joy in the word, who feel the energy in the word.
Well, you know, you're passionate about a lot of things, and it's clear you're very passionate about poetry as well.
Yes.
You're known for your deep passions. Mm. Let's take another call. Liz in Marin County, California. Hi, Liz.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Ms. Paglia, I was just wondering what, if any, influence Harold Bloom has had on you and what you think of his works.
Well, I tell the story in the intro that when I was a graduate student at Yale University, Harold Bloom summoned me to his office. He'd heard the project I was working on, which became Sexual Personae, my first book, and he said, "My dear, I am the only one who can direct that dissertation." So there began a great collaboration. He is my mentor, and it could not have been a better association. No one understood my ideas except for Harold Bloom. All those years when I couldn't get published, my first book was rejected by 7 publishers and 5 agents and so on, and he just believed in my ideas, and his whole affirmative attitude toward literature, his enormous erudition, these are great models for me. So I'm very happy for my connection with him, and even though he's he's persona non grata in many circles, the trendy circles of post-structuralism, post-modernism, from coast to coast in the United States, he is beloved as a champion of art everywhere around the world. He is the most famous literary critic in the world, and I think that he's certainly the leading critic of our time.
Thanks so much for your call, Liz.
Thank you.
The first poem in your book is a Shakespearean sonnet. You conclude the book with a song by Joni Mitchell, Woodstock. We're going to hear a little bit of that and then talk about that. Here's that tape.
I came upon a child of God. He was walking along the road, and I asked him, "Where are you going?" And this he told me, "I'm going on down to Yasgur's farm. I'm gonna join in a rock." Try and get
Shakespeare and Joni Mitchell. They're both in your book. Why? What do they have in common?
Well, I begin with Shakespeare because so much in the history of English poetry goes back to him and is inspired by him. But I end with Woodstock because I concluded after in the 5 years of working on this book that Woodstock is the most important and influential poem written in English since Sylvia Plath's Daddy. What you just played is not that widely known, which is Joni Mitchell herself singing the song. It was recorded only a few months different from the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song, which everybody knows, the mega hit that is still on global airplay. I think that you can tell that when Joni Mitchell sings her lyric, that it's really a kind of elegy, a lament for the ideals of the 60s that were too utopian, that never could, in fact, be effected in human life. Therefore, what we hear in Joni Mitchell's version, okay, is this is affirmation of the 60s idealism, but also a sense of critique of its limitations. Her performance is in itself a work of art.
Let's take another call now from Tulsi in Gainesville, Florida. Go ahead, Tulsi.
Hi. I first want to say I'm really thrilled to be able to talk to you.
Thanks.
I've just started reading some of your stuff in the past couple of years and have not worked my way through everything available, but I love your writing, and I'm very happy to have a chance to talk to you, and I hope you can come to Gainesville at some point to the University of Florida and speak.
Would love it. Thank you.
Question I have, and please excuse me, bear with me a little bit because I speak a lot slower than I think, so it takes a little while to get it out. What I'm trying to understand here is that I've read in some articles, I think, that you have championed a view of popular culture as being worthy of inclusion in the canon of art, is specifically, I think I remember things relating to images of women and, you know, how back in the day, you know, the feminists were, you know, saying that this is all exploitation. You're saying, no, it's art. And I'm just wondering how popular culture, and especially the way in which popular culture is created and presented through high technology, hasn't, in fact, either destroyed or at least led to the demise of these more traditional forms, you know, especially poetry, in how we perceive art. You know, it seems like if it doesn't have flashing lights and fast, you know, 20 cuts per second or something like that, it doesn't grab our attention. So I'm just wondering, you know, do you think that there is a relation between how the technology of art and also the content as it is now, what we consider to be, you know, in popular culture, that it hasn't just basically, you know, fed on the past and destroyed it in the process?
Well, I'm very concerned about the decline in the quality of popular culture since the early 90s. I'm really appalled how we're in a period of just what you say. It's kind of flashing special effects. Animation is actually booming, you know, as an art form, but at what cost to the performing arts? The actual performing arts are suffering. Live performing arts are suffering from that. And I think there is a kind of shallowness to American popular culture. Hollywood hasn't produced an interesting movie to me in years, and I'm actually on strike from going to the theater. Let it go to video, all right, until there's something that I really think is worth me going to the movies for. So, for someone who is such an evangelist for popular culture, you know, I've been kind of in shock about what's happened. But I think the web, in its emergence in the mid '90s and so on, as a mass medium, is absorbing the cultural energy that used to go into the performing arts. But yes, indeed, my first book, Sexual Personae, argues that modern popular culture is in the great main line of Greco-Roman paganism, and that it really is a return of the gods and the goddesses. I did indeed argue that an image like Elizabeth Taylor and sewed into her white slip in Butterfield 8 was like an image of a goddess, Botticelli's Venus, and so on. I actually teach a course at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia called Gender Images and Media. For 15 years, I've been assembling slides, images from the history of movies and advertising and entertainment, and to try to show the way male and female have been defined and redefined through the giant structure of the Hollywood studio era and so on and so forth. At any rate, I think that perhaps that was a kind of self-contained period, that period of the 20th century, and we're embarked into some other new era where educators and cultural organizations have to take arms, okay, to restore the fine arts to the most basic level, the primary school, middle school, high school, and, you know, in college, to put them at the center, because without that, our young are just drifting off in this very sterile landscape, cheap shots, bad acting, bad scripts, lousy cinematography, but all eye candy, everything in your face, constantly. And of course, tech constantly changing, the latest cell phones, you know, the latest computers, on and on. I mean, this is a great art form in itself, high technology, but without the arts, you have a culture that is spiritually empty.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Tulsi. My guest is Camille Paglia. She is the author of the new book, Break, Blow, Burn. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take another call now from Rebecca. And Rebecca is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
I have to say, I am delighted to hear this conversation. I just finished my MFA in poetry. And I found myself, well, so poetry is basically part of my daily life, but I found myself doing something that I never thought I would do, which is teaching at a very small, very rural high school in South Carolina. And we started recently on poetry. We started with romantic poetry, and the children, when I assigned two poems the first night, and they said, "Why do we have to do this? We've never read a poem in our lives." And I thought, my God. So when they came back the next day, of course, they grumbled and moaned, and they said, "We don't get this. We don't understand it. He doesn't talk like us." But what I found is, in going through, and of course you have to make it very basic for them, but if you go through and we talk about first, okay, what is going on? What can I understand here? And then how does this make me feel? And then let's look at the language. How is the language affecting the way that you feel? How is it working into the greater whole here? And what I found is, they get it after a while, and now they're learning to read it on their own. And the look on their faces, it's almost physical, really, when they get it. And now they're also, we're gradually moving into, they're writing their own poetry, which is phenomenal. And it makes me, every day when I come home from work, I just feel, it's such a relief from the academic world I just came from, getting my graduate degree, and it's such a relief from the world they come from, I think, the MTV and you know, all that going on. And I think we've created a nice place to be in my classroom for, you know, 50 minutes or so. And I think it's a wonderful thing.
Thanks so much for your call, Rebecca.
Oh, that's great. What a wonderful story about the revelation that's possible in poetry. That's great.
I wonder, Camille Paglia, you included 43 poems in your book. Was there a 44th? What were the ones you had to leave out?
There were some. Well, you know, I wanted something by Allen Ginsberg, because Ginsberg had influenced me so hugely when I was in college, but nothing quite worked out. I was thinking, should I excerpt Howell or not? And then so that really, you know, bothered me. And then you know, there are other there were some. I would say there weren't poems by famous poets that failed to make the cut. There were a number of poems I found by obscure poets that I thought were very interesting. I would like to have put in, but I felt the book had a, you know, a kind of natural shape to it, and I just ended at 43.
And do you have some advice for people who are intimidated by poetry? If you had one piece of advice, what would you give to people?
Go blank. Go completely blank in front of the poem. Just read it. Read it and let it work its magic on you, okay? There should be no anxiety, right? And what I've tried to do in my book is to write these very short commentaries that take you through the poem from beginning to end, and try to keep you in the mood of the poem. I interpret every single word that might be troublesome, and try to show you how it works, how it looks on the page, page as well. And I'm hoping that the poem will reach the kind of general reader who has an interest, but perhaps feels somewhat intimidated by poetry or hasn't read it in years.
Camille Paglia is the author of Break, Blow, Burn. Camille Paglia reads 43 of the world's best poems. She joined us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
And you can read the introduction to Paglia's book, Break, Blow, and Burn, and one of the selected poems at our website, npr.org. When we come back from a short break, we'll learn which newsrooms are breaking out the champagne right now to celebrate this year's Pulitzer Prize winners. They were announced less than an hour ago. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.